Well, turns out Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf got what he wanted, a budget deal passed by the legislature before Christmas. Now, whether he'll sign it is another matter. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The Pennsylvania Senate today passed a budget bill previously passed by the House that does not include Governor Wolf's preferred spending increase for schools. Meanwhile, nonprofits have been scraping by without any funds flowing from the state. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that groups in southeastern Pennsylvania are frustrated and have banded together to try to make sure they're never in this position again.
It can be hard for regular people to relate to something as impersonal sounding as a state budget impasse. Maria Macaluso, executive director of the Women's Center of Montgomery County, makes this comparison.
We have $1 million budget and about two-thirds, roughly, of our funds were tied up in federal and state funds. So I tell people, imagine in your own household trying to operate on a third of what you normally would have.
To cope, the Women's Center has organized emergency fundraisers and stopped paying some staff to keep up most of their services. Other groups haven't been so lucky.
Some have maxed out one, two, and up to three lines of credit and aren't able to get any more.
Ann Gingerich leads the Pennsylvania Association of Nonprofit Organizations.
Some organizations have scaled back on what they're able to offer. Some organizations are only providing just emergency services or a hotline and have asked their employees to stay home without pay.
Her group has been holding calls with nonprofit leaders across the state to share tips and legal advice about weathering this hard time. They're also gathering agency directors to focus on changing state policy in the event of another impasse.
We are going to be starting to meet in January to start looking at and advocating for a process and system to be put in place so that this doesn't happen year over year and hold the nonprofit community hostage.
Gingerich and Macaluso say the lack of public awareness and outcry about all of the things the state hasn't been funding is disheartening. Macaluso says even when the money starts to flow again, some of the education and prevention work the Women's Center has scaled back on will take a while to build up, and that can have a long-term effect.
That's the saddest thing, because if you're not doing the prevention work, then in 20 years we'll be counseling the daughters of the women that we're counseling now.
I'm Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Philadelphia is on track to record fewer than 300 homicides for a third consecutive year. Though, as WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, anti-violence activists are far from satisfied.
With just over a week left in 2015, Philadelphia police have recorded 269 slayings. That total is higher than 2014 and 2013, which each ended with fewer than 250 homicides, historic lows. Dorothy Johnson Spite founded Mothers in Charge after her son was killed in 2001. She says the city is still too violent.
It's always significant when we have a reduction in homicides in the city. However, to place 300 as the number that we're happy that it's below, I still have a problem with, because 300 families, 300 individuals have lost their life to senseless violence.
Scott Charles, trauma outreach coordinator with Temple University Hospital, agrees.
We become somewhat inured to the level of violence. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that we can recall having 400 homicides and, you know, by comparison, 247 or 248, or if by the end of the year we have somewhere near 270 homicides, it still seems like progress.
Johnson Spite says things won't significantly change until a number of underlying issues are addressed.
A lot of the violence that we see is because people can't manage their anger, don't know how, don't have tools to do what is needed to walk away from a situation. That and the availability of guns in our city and cities across this country, that makes for the situations that we see. Poverty is another issue.
From 2007 to 2012, Philadelphia had at least 300 homicides a year. In 2007, there were nearly 400. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Philadelphia's 99th mayor, Jim Kenney, will be inaugurated into office Monday, January 4th. And in advance of that transition, NewsWorks Tonight is looking at the legacy of outgoing mayor Michael Nutter. In this evening's sixth installment of a seven-part series, let's look at business and the economy. And for that, joining me is Alex Balloon, director of the Tacony Community Development Corporation. Alex, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And for listeners who may or may not know where the Tacony section is, describe it.
It's an historic community about 8 miles north of downtown Center City, Philadelphia, along the banks of the Delaware. It's what we would refer to as the lower northeast.
And describe the demographic.
It's a diverse community. It's got a historical working class background. It's gotten more diverse in the past, I'd say, 20, 30 years. We have more Latino families, African Americans, immigrant business owners.
When Nutter took office, shortly thereafter, the recession hit. And as you cite these minority communities, Black, Latino, I imagine they were hurt first in the recession.
They certainly were. And we, in our portion of the city, had one of the highest foreclosure rates in the city of Philadelphia. So often we were particularly hit hard by that recession because a lot of those jobs were some of the first to go.
So here we are, the end of 2015. Is the Tacony section back to where it was pre-onset of the recession?
Not quite. We've made great progress. We're still clearing a lot of foreclosures out of the backlog that are bank-owned, but we're making new investments on our commercial corridor, and we are getting much closer to where we were before the recession.
Though Tacony's not in Center City, it was the Greater Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce that put out this 2015 roadmap for growth, and the whole point is developing this shared partnership agenda with incoming Mayor Jim Kenney. To what extent do you know about Kenney's intents with regard to the Tacony neighborhood?
Jim Kenney's put forward a lot of interesting ideas. One of his hallmarks that I've heard him refer to multiple times is taking East Passyunk, which is a vibrant dining commercial corridor, to other areas of the city. And he also refers to the fact that every neighborhood matters. So he really wants to invest more heavily in neighborhoods. I think that creates a lot of opportunities to help take some low-cost, high-impact techniques that were proven in East Passyunk to other neighborhoods and other commercial corridors.
If you had access to him and could present him with a wish list, what might be a top priority or two in terms of helping the Tacony section?
I'd like to see him continue Mayor Nutter's business security grant program, which provided a grant to business owners to install high-quality security cameras and supplement public security with additional video footage that was registered also with the Philadelphia Police Department. So that was a really great public-private partnership to extend security. So that would be one program I would keep under Mayor Kenney. The second would be the storefront improvement program, which Mayor Kenney has already said that he wants to, in fact, double the funding for. In that program, business owners propose improvements that are pedestrian-oriented, so oriented towards customers and shoppers. It's often fresh paint, new signage, new windows, new doors. The city matches 50% of the cost of that improvement and then reviews the proposed design. The business owner then goes forward with those improvements, and then the business owner is reimbursed after the project is completed. The City of Philadelphia Commerce Department did a study on that program and found that, I can tell you, in Tacony, some stores that participated had sales increases of up to 20%.
For listeners not familiar with Tacony, perhaps not living in Philadelphia proper, come to Tacony for what? What's a great restaurant? What's a great thing to see?
I love to brag about our hoagie trail. We have three of the best hoagie shops in Philadelphia, and each one makes homemade meats and sausage. So it's a great low-cost, on a nice day, getaway.
And for non-retail, what's a great site or location or vista?
I would recommend Lardner's Point Park. It's a beautiful view of the Tacony-Palmyra Bridge over the North Delaware. Looking over to New Jersey, you can see a beautiful waterfront.
I'll bring the hoagies. I'll meet you on the bridge.
That sounds like a deal.
Alex, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Alex Balloon, director of the Tacony Community Development Corporation. And you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Taking a look at this evening's headlines. As we mentioned, the Pennsylvania State Senate is advancing budget legislation that it previously opposed. Republicans say it's the only way to give Democratic Governor Tom Wolf a bill that can end a six-month-long stalemate before Christmas, speeding money to school districts and social service agencies. Senate Majority Leader Jay Corman says the bill's passage does not mean the talks have ended on a wider bipartisan budget deal that stalled. The bill passed on a near party line vote, 33-17. A federal judge in Pennsylvania is keeping jailed a 19-year-old accused of trying to assist the Islamic State group, advocating violence against American citizens, and helping people travel to Syria. Magistrate Judge Marty Carlson has ruled that Jalil Ibn Amir Aziz represents a danger to the public and may flee if he's released. 62 degrees at 6:16. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Periods of rain this evening, remaining cloudy overnight. Temperatures holding on in the low 60s. Now tomorrow, cloudy, high all the way to 76 degrees. PM showers likely. For Christmas Day, some breaks of sunshine amid the clouds. Friday's high, 66. Still ahead, New Yorkers may like to boast, but if flood projections come true, Philadelphia could end up on top.
A lot of your people either live here or Brooklyn, so maybe we'll get an edge up on Brooklyn because, you know, it'll be underwater.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Yes, it is the thought that counts, but sometimes the packaging is a nice surprise, too.
It's like, wow, you're almost more appreciative for the time and effort it took to put into wrapping the gift and the gift itself.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How gift wrapping got wrapped up into the American holiday tradition, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace follows Newsworks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
New Jersey's Clean Energy Program proudly supports WHYY. New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, incentivizing businesses, local governments, schools, and residents to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects, existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing in your home and business with support from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The good news out of the Paris climate talks means countries have finally come together to cut carbon emissions. But here's the bad news. A lot of damage to the atmosphere has already been done. Seas will still rise. How much and how soon is up for debate. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on how Philadelphia fares better than a lot of other cities.
If the oceans rise as predicted, huge swaths of Boston, New York, and Miami will be underwater by the end of this century. Compared to those cities, Philadelphia's future looks great. It's a good 60 miles from the Atlantic Ocean. That's good news for most residents, and some say the city could take advantage of its relatively high ground position along the East Coast to attract more investment and more people.
We could easily take another million people into this city. We have the infrastructure. We have the space.
Chris Crockett is an engineer with the Philadelphia Water Department. He's in charge of planning for climate change.
And this was a city that was designed for 2.5 million people.
But today there's only 1.5 million people. That leaves a lot of empty row houses that could be filled with climate refugees and a lot of office space for businesses looking for higher ground. So I was eager to share this good news with my fellow Philadelphians who typically need an ego boost.
Philadelphia, we actually is underrated, understated, and I noticed a lot.
I met Chanel Phillips outside City Hall in front of the ice rink, where Christmas shoppers were enjoying the 65-degree weather. She says she'd welcome newcomers like Charlie Mueller.
Well, I mean, a lot of young people already live here.
The 23-year-old AmeriCorps volunteer was having lunch outside with his coworkers. He's originally from Rochester.
A lot of young people either live here or Brooklyn, so maybe we'll get an edge up on Brooklyn because, you know, it'll be underwater. We won't be able to go to Atlantic City anymore. People will come here, so maybe we'll see some of that business move to Philadelphia. Who knows? Yeah, definitely Brooklyn's underwater. I'll come here. Maybe invest in property.
If he does invest in property, he should heed the advice of newly arrived resident Samantha Baker Evans, who moved to Philly with her family after careful examination.
Then we looked at Atlanta, we looked at Boston, we looked at Chicago, we looked at San Francisco. We spent our time looking around, and Philly was the one that we liked.
And so sea level rise did not figure into your decision whatsoever.
It very much did when we bought a house. Last year we bought a house and I was looking at the flood maps because that same time that the predictions that New Jersey was going to lose a good chunk of its coast were coming out.
And those flood maps told her to stay away from areas lining the Delaware River or Eastwick in southwest Philadelphia. So she chose Frankfurt. But not everyone thinks propping the city up with climate refugees is such a good idea.
That's crazy talk.
Joe Gordon is from Abington. He didn't see an influx of people as good news at all.
We are already seeing the political turmoil over the impact of refugees from terror. It's going to get far worse if we have people fleeing from and massive dislocation from flooding anywhere in the country. If we have people coming here because they've lost everything, that's not going to be easy.
Deborah Brooks was visiting from Baltimore, but says she loves Philadelphia. She's worried that climate change may force lots of people to look for new homes.
It's a reason why they're going to Mars. It's a reason why they're trying to get to these other planets, right? It's a reason for them sending a spaceship up there. I think God wanted it to be a natural planet. And what happens in 3039? You're going to live up there and leave us down here to suffer?
The year 3039 is a long way off, but predictions have the ocean rising much sooner. And even the city's port could benefit. After all, the Delaware River won't have to be dredged again. Climate change will take care of the deepening. Darrell Treadwell thought it just might be too far into the future to think about.
I don't know. Centuries go by. Philadelphia might be a nice place to be in with the climate change. You think the water's going to rise?
Yes. Tides along the Delaware River could be 2 feet higher in just 35 years, according to some climate predictions. And although that will lead to more flooding in neighborhoods east of I-95, it's nothing like what Miami, New York, and Boston face. And this, some say, could be the perfect opportunity to reverse the city's second-class status and become the industrial powerhouse Philadelphia once was. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The city's Pig Iron Theater Company is reviving one of its early shows called Gentlemen Volunteers to celebrate the company's 20th year. Pig Iron was started by a bunch of scrappy Swarthmore grads. Gentlemen Volunteers was first performed in a West Philadelphia church basement. WHYY theater blogger Howard Shapiro saw the revival of Gentlemen Volunteers and offers this review.
There really were gentlemen volunteers with all-American grit at the beginning of what would be World War I. The U.S. hadn't yet entered the war, but young men from around the country signed up with the Red Cross to become ambulance drivers in Europe. They went to battlefields and picked up wounded Allied soldiers to take them to hospitals. In 1998, Pig Iron Theater Company, whose brand of productions was often called experimental theater, decided to do a show called Gentlemen Volunteers. It had many of the hallmarks that would become staples in later Pig Iron productions. The audience walked around a large room to see each scene in a different place. There was text, but also a lot of plot advanced by mime. And there was also music. Here's Melissa Crodman, who plays a chanteuse and a nurse in the current production. One of the five cast members, Michael Castillejos, plays the accordion. Much of Pig Iron's show is set on the battlefields of France, where two Yaleys find themselves driving an ambulance and also falling in love with French nurses. The show's text is in both French and English, and if you don't understand French, you can get the idea of what's being said by context. I had a lot more trouble getting some of the miming. It took me a while to figure out that actors were miming the outlines of a room before the start of a scene, or showing us the internal emotions of other characters. The revival is directed by Dan Rothenberg, a Pig Iron co-founder who directed the original, and my guess is that this Gentlemen Volunteers isn't as sharp as it was in 1998 with the cast that created it. There was a time when walking around a room to see a play as it unfolded was cool, and it still is if there's a point to it. But here I couldn't find the point, and as I wandered around, I got little feeling for these characters in love amid the chaos of war. Maybe Gentlemen Volunteers doesn't come through in this production, or maybe we've just outgrown it. It runs at Christ Church Neighborhood House in Center City through December 27th. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
These days, holly takes a backseat to mistletoe and poinsettias. But holly wreaths were once big business for a southern Delaware town. WHYY's Mark Eichmann has more from the Delaware desk.
Milton, Delaware laid claim to the title of Holly Wreath Capital of America, with trains transporting fresh holly wreaths from Sussex County to homes and major department stores in Philadelphia, New York, and beyond. Naturally plentiful holly trees in the area in the early 1900s helped birth a big industry for local farmers after the harvest season.
So this is kind of your secret holly stash.
This is my holly. Where I get my holly.
Mike Wajda still makes holly wreaths from some of the limited supply left in Milton.
As you can see, it's very prickly, so you got to be very, very careful.
As we walked through his friend's holly grove, Wajda tells the story of Milton's former holly wreath king, farmer Charles Jones.
He made wreaths for Radio City Music Hall. John Wanamaker's was a famous department store in Philadelphia and also in Wilmington. He did wreaths for them.
So how did the holly business start in Milton?
By the early 20th century, a lot of communities similar to Milton were starved economically, so people needed to be creative.
Russ McCabe is Delaware's former state archivist.
You know, in the late 1930s, the state of Delaware, the state legislature, recognized the holly tree as the state tree.
And while Christmas spirit was only growing,
particularly in the cities for holly wreaths, Christmas trees, things of that nature,
consumer taste was rolling downhill fast.
The thing that really ended that industry was the advent of plastic. I mean, let's face it, you can get a plastic wreath and put it in the attic and it looks the same next year as it did last year. You can't do that with the real thing.
Ad development that depleted much of Milton's holly groves and the wreath-making industry wilted. But in his friend's secret holly grove, Mike Wajda keeps the legacy alive.
There's too many artificial things out there, but this is the real thing, which is a good thing.
These days, Milton is much better known as the home of Dogfish Head beer, which, like holly, is also exported far and wide.
It's our beer. We like to brag on it. In a town that was once known for its strong temperance movement, Dogfish Head has completely turned things around and done it in a very positive way.
From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or check us out at newsworks.org. The winter holidays bring lots of traditions. One universal theme is food, food, food. On tomorrow's show, we'll talk with a local researcher whose new book examines how women view food and femininity. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.